everybody. Welcome to another edition of the Janet Foster Show. And, you know, this is the show where you get real talk for action. And just want to just let you know that you can get social with me right now live on Facebook at Janet Foster, and you'll see the post for tonight's show. Just post any questions that you have there, and certainly on Instagram and Twitter, you can catch me at Janet D. Foster, and that's D for Deborah. And I do have some questions already that I've received from you. And thank you for our power listeners. And I just want to recognize some of our power listeners. Herb Life Official, thanks so much for the love. And Austin Silver, thank you for your shout out. And Millennial Week, as always, you always share and always get good questions for us. And I appreciate your input for this week. And the 88 Wonders, thank you so much for your question. And, just to kind of a pickup of what's going on here on the, here on the West Coast, we're kind of doing our things. We're all leaving. A lot of you are leaving work right now on your way home. Some of you might be caught up in the March Madness. I know it's pretty quiet here on the West Coast in terms of basketball. But I definitely want to keep you up to date with what's going on in terms of some primary action that's going on right now. We've got states that we're still in the quest for the two major parties for them to select their nominees. And tonight we did have another set of primaries. And tonight on the Republican side of the House, we've got Hawaii, Idaho, Michigan, and Mississippi that have primaries tonight. And right now, the two polls have closed in Michigan and in Mississippi. In Mississippi, Trump won. We can go ahead and call that one now. He got all 40 delegates. And Michigan, the polls just closed, and just with 17% of just 17% of the precincts reporting. Trump is leading. At stake in Michigan on the Republican side are 59 delegates. And polls that are yet to be closed, that they're still open, and it's going to be a long night. Idaho tonight, they close at 8 o'clock their time, which there's another hour. So when it's 7 o'clock here in California, Idaho, their polls will be closing, and there are 32 delegates at stake there for the Republicans. And Hawaii, their polls close at, interesting enough, East Coast time. It's, not even East Coast time, but Pacific time, our time, 10 p.m. our time is when the polls in Hawaii will close. And there are 19 delegates there. And of course, right now, the way things stand with Mississippi being called, Trump is in the lead. He has 384 pledged delegates. And to get the nomination on the Republican side, is his magic number is 1,237. And right now in the delegate pool, there are 1,585 delegates still available, and it's still a four-man race so far. Somehow, in my own prediction, there'll be someone that will be leaving that race. And on the Democratic side tonight, and we're going to focus on the Democrats tonight. And I know I've had some listeners that said, you've been talking a lot about Republicans. And a lot of you reminded me that of quite a few people that reminded me, didn't you work communications for the Democratic Party? And yes, I did. And, as a journalist, I am trying to be balanced, and we are getting balanced for sure. But just to give you an update on the Democratic side of the House in terms of primaries, because not every, just because of what you, for some of you, some of our young voters and our young listeners, not every single state and every single party, they don't mirror not like California. I know most people kind of think about how we do it here in California, but it's a little bit different. Tonight, on the Democratic side of the House, there are only two primaries, and that's in Michigan and Mississippi, which is what they have in common with what's going on the Republican side of the House. And both of those states are what's called closed, meaning you've got to be a registered Democrat to vote. And right now with Mississippi, with the polls being closed in Mississippi, Hillary Clinton won. She took a pickup of 36 delegates. And right now, Michigan, with the polls closing with 19% of the precincts reporting, Sanders is leading. But we know that Hillary Clinton does very well in some of those loyal Democratic strongholds. Detroit has not been counted. So and a lot of which that's the largest urban area, but there are still more precincts to come into. And right now the count stands for Hillary Clinton at 1,134 pledged delegates, and for Bernie Sanders, 502 pledged delegates. And for the Democratic nomination, the winner, the individual who gets the nomination, needs 2,383 to get the nomination. And right now in the delegate pool, there are 3,129 delegates available. So, it's going to be an interesting night. And, last week was Super Tuesday. And that kind of leads me into my guest for tonight. One of the things that we talk about, with this show is that for what we do in terms of political conversations, also current events, and everything that we talk about here is geared to specifically to two audiences, and that's Gen Xers and millennials. And me, the Gen Xer, I'm all about doing things a new way, and definitely our listeners, and I just want to thank you, because a lot of the feedback that you've given, we've incorporated a lot into making this a new way to do radio, a new way to talk about things. And one of the things that I have I've been excited about is, I told you that we would look for people who you need to know and who you need to follow and get social with on social media. Well, my guest today is that individual. I've been watching him for the past month, and I looked at his postings on social media, primarily Twitter, and he is someone who in the social media field and area that you should follow. He's someone who is balanced, and my guest today, he's currently a graduate student, an MBA candidate at Yale University, and he's a part of the group Millennials for Hillary. And what we're going to do today is we're going to break down these primaries that have happened so far in terms of the millennial view, because that's something that's been, it's definitely been missing quite a bit, particularly on the Democrats, side. And I want to also bring attention that my guest, he also wrote a very interesting op-ed in his school's newspaper, the Yale Daily News. And I have, without further ado, I'd like to introduce you to my guest. His name is Kaivon Shroff. Did I get that correct?
Kaivon, but close.
Kaivon, you're absolutely right. And I've actually said it, and I apologize for that. I won't miss it again. But Kaivon, you are one of the millennials, because I talk a lot about people who do things. And this show is a show where we not only talk about issues or talk about things, but we talk about things that you can act on. Because, a lot in talk radio, people complain, people do all kinds of things, but then they just leave it there. Those aren't the kind of guests that I like to have on the show. And those haven't been the kinds of guests that I've engaged. I like engaging people who are doing something, people who are articulate about what they're doing. And you fit the bill. And like I told you, I had been watching you for over a month, and I just said, you know what? I got to. So when I reached out and when I reached out to you, I was so excited because I said, I know the audience is going to appreciate everything that you have to share, because what I like the most about what you you provide on Twitter is, you know, Twitter is a 140 character game. Really smart people have to be on your game to not only share pertinent information, but also the way you do it is so hip and so cool. So, definitely, you caught my eye, and I said, let me watch this. And I am a policy junkie. But I don't like the wonky discussions either, because that does nothing for anyone either. So, but I like the mix, and you're definitely a millennial that we all need to know, and people need to follow. So, what I wanted to do was just kind of talk to you a little bit first about your article, because I think the op-ed that you wrote in your school newspaper, it's a great narrative from your generation's perspective on what's going on in the Democratic Party from a young person's point of view, but also how I like it is that you really give an observation of both sides, basically the two major Democratic candidates. Can you talk to us? Can you share with the audience, because some of our audience may have not read the article, so kind of break that down to us and kind of share some of your thought process with that.
Sure. So basically what the article gets into is an extended metaphor comparing Hillary Clinton to a more medical assessment of the problems that the country is facing today versus Bernie Sanders, who kind of has more of a religious, groupthink, gospel-y vibe to his movement, I think. And I think when you look at the way that candidates tackle an issue, like take, for example, in the article I talk about how they want to treat the war on drugs. And both candidates are against the war on drugs. Obviously, it's led to a lot of failed policy and really bad results on a systemic level. I think that, you know, having agreed on that, and I think that is generally my generation's kind of is pro decriminalization, at least, of marijuana. You look to Bernie Sanders and he's just like, oh, okay, we're going to decriminalize. Let's go full speed ahead with no real outline of how that works. And I think that most people can understand that, you know, when you already have a policy in place, no matter how bad it is, to move away from that policy, you can't just undo everything like that. You have to have a gradual step. Whereas Clinton's plan, you know, she wants to first reschedule it so that it's tied to less severe sentencing, mm-hmm. and then take data from states, which she calls the Research Labs of America, and let states that have already legalized kind of inform us about what the different policy concerns will be. And mm-hmm. it's just so much more detailed. I don't know if you caught the Democratic debate, I'm guessing you did, in Flint, where, you know, even on an issue like Flint, she's able to come up with a detailed plan for how she's going to deal with the water crisis in Flint, even as president. And by the way, even if people don't believe she's going to do that, the fact that she's able to articulate that is important. And I think that the idea that Bernie Sanders, you know, is this underdog, et cetera, candidate, and he should be cut slack for not having, you know, the team Hillary has, you know, now it's been months and months. He's raised millions and millions of dollars. And I think it's a harder sell that, you know, he doesn't have his stuff together enough to come up with these detailed policy plans. So I think it's concerning.
Your point about you've got several points I want to talk to you about. Yeah. The first one is your generation's view about the war on drugs and decriminalization of marijuana in particularly. And you know, most of our listeners here in California, you know, we've had legalized weed, access to weed, for more than a decade. And right. For us, it's kind of a non-issue when people talk about talk about that other than on the federal level. And I think, and what I find with some millennials that I talk to, some know that there's a federal level to it. And then some just, I think they're more hippie about it in terms of it's just an herb, you know, live and let live. And like what you said, you know, the details that are needed, I think are something that needs to be talked about. And, you know, hearing you break this down and, you know, in terms of your generation, it's not that you're an anomaly, but it's kind of different because everybody is following with the majority of some of the folks that we've surveyed, not only here in California, but in some of our other audience areas. The majority of millennials, they remember Bill Clinton as kids, depending on their age. But we're finding, though, for millennials under 25, it's more Bernie than anything because of what's being said, and maybe those details might be too much. You know, do you have any thoughts on that?
I do. You know, I think that a big part, at least for my peer group of, and I don't want to sort of dismiss people that like Bernie as just like caught up in hype, because I really don't think it is just that. But
exactly.
I do think, you know, Hillary Clinton has basically been the presumed front runner of the Democratic Party since 2012 after Obama was reelected. It was kind of like, okay, who's next? Hillary Clinton's next. And so there's nothing exciting about 4 years later supporting Hillary Clinton, because that was what was expected 4 years ago. So, you know, I think for people that are first-time voters, for people that are just sort of, you know, in school learning about different things and getting involved in politics for the first time, of course it's more exciting to support somebody that hasn't been around forever, somebody that wasn't assumed to be, you know, the candidate for your party. And I think that that's fair. I think, though, I am surprised how long that has stayed, because I feel like he really hasn't answered any of the criticisms that he's faced in terms of foreign policy experience, in terms of, you know, how he's paying for things. You know, so many economists have come out saying that his plans don't make sense, that yes, you can say, oh, well, they're all part of the establishment and they're all and blah, blah, blah. Bernie has two economists that are willing to say that his plan works. But I mean, it's really quite the conspiracy theory that none of his coworkers in Congress really support him. None of these like leaders in their field are rallying behind him. At some point you can say, oh, it's all the establishment that's so corrupt. Or, you know, it's probably a mix of both. And so I'd like to see people acknowledge that just a little bit more.
You're right. One of the things that in a lot of interviews that I've done with Democrats and some of the focus groups that I've done on this election, there's a clear-cut view about establishment versus Bernie. And that is exactly how not just millennials view them, but other Democrats. I have to say, in the Gen X group, we've got quite a few Gen Xers. And a lot of this whole, I think, establishment thing comes from that no one recognizes or even has vocalized, has been, you know, Bernie's been an independent. And the fact, though, that he talks about an establishment, a funding source, a party platform that, yeah, he caucused, but he was never accountable to it. He doesn't stand 100% behind a lot of major areas that a lot of the superdelegates, because that's where a lot of his colleagues are placed in, those superdelegates, whether they're in the Senate or even in the House. You know, things like gun control, things like that, where the party has a hard line on, and he kind of tiptoed around it. And, I mean, it's one thing when he tiptoes around by saying he represents a rural state, but he still can't identify with, say, a blue dog Democrat from the South who has similar rural ideals. And also, too, gun ownership in the South is, one of those things where Bernie could fall in line with that. But because he is technically an independent, the large portion of the base of the Democratic Party doesn't know him. And it seems like he is being carried by a lot of young people who may not think about that or may not even be aware. They just know, they may know, yeah, he caucused, but I don't think that they realize his voting record in terms of, other major things like gun control. But you're right about his colleagues not stepping up. And one of those economists that's willing to step for him happens to be here on the West Coast at UC Berkeley, Professor Reich, which that was very surprising that he would endorse anyone at this early stage. And but he's all in on Team Bernie. So definitely. But you got thoughts?
I'm surprised this narrative of him not being establishment has stuck so strongly, because at the end of the day, he's, an older, white, straight man who's been in Congress for 30 years. So, on the spectrum of the establishment, quote unquote, he's really up there. He might be less establishment than Hillary Clinton, who was Secretary of State and First Lady and is married to a president. Yes, I think there's benefits that come with that history. But at some point, it's kind of like all these super liberal people have just abandoned everything they think about, gender equality, everything they think about, all these different issues to support this candidate. Because I think even the way that gender has been handled in this election by the Democratic Party is shocking to me, because I think, yes, race is a critical issue at this time. Yes, the economy and inequality and all those things are so important, but gender inequality is still very real. I think that there's so many ways that Hillary Clinton experiences it, whether it's they're questioning her yelling and saying, oh, she doesn't know that the mic's on at any of this, how many pundits have said that. I don't know if you caught that.
Yes, yes.
He only yells. So in my opinion. But, it's rough to see somebody say, oh, she doesn't know how to use the mic and blah, blah, blah. I think that does have sexist undertones to it. I don't know that we wouldn't be seeing, more coverage on that if Bernie wasn't sort of facing her right now, because I think it's really sort of shut down that conversation entirely.
It has. And I also, and you're right about some of the gender things, I'm going to do something that most women always see, either this or this. Oh, it's one. Those are one of the two things that women, regardless to what we do. And I saw a lot of this and a lot of and even the little shake, which kind of I thought, wow, he's really familiar. And you're absolutely right about a lot of the gender differences going on. And depending on who is trying to, convince the public at large, the gender card gets played quite a bit in terms of people saying, I'm not with her, because that's the latest. It's the latest social media tag right now. And that kind of gets into your group, Millennials for Hillary. And your handle is it still with her?
Yes.
Yes. I think that's brilliant. I think it's brilliant at how you pulled that together. Now, in your article, too, the way you labeled it, religion or therapy, that really caught my eye, because I thought, oh, this is an interesting way of doing it. And definitely, with Bernie, the religion, and it's a cult following, definitely. And just to our listeners who are Bernie supporters, not cult in a bad way. I think it's a culture following. So I'm using cult as a short term, but, you're right where he doesn't detail how things are going to be paid for. And he comes up with these lists of things, but one of the things that neither candidate is speaking about, and even the Democratic Party at large is speaking about, is they're not doing a lot of proactive discussioning or coordinating with either camp on what happens if we get another dysfunctional Congress. Because regardless of what either of these candidates say, when we already know what a dysfunctional Congress can do, and we're witnessing it now, and people kind of forget how the executive branch works. You know, people can, the person running for president can say, I'll give you free money every day, but the way things work is Congress makes the laws. Yes, the president has some line item things and certain other privileges, but they just can't haul off and do things. And that's one of the things that Bernie, he never gets that direct question about, but that asking him about how you're paying for something, that's kind of that way. Do you find that in any of your dialogue with any of your peers, does that kind of come up with, talking about the branches, how what's realistic?
I think to Hillary Clinton's credit, I think she will not say she will do something. So when they ask her a question, if it's not within the powers of the presidency, rarely will she say, I will do this. She will say, I will work with Congress. I will try to do this. And it's not really a sexy answer, which is, I'm honestly surprised because, obviously her campaign knows that viewers are probably a little bit less sophisticated about this thing than you, for example, who's like spent a career doing this. And so it's easy to say, yes, I'll do it. Yes, I'll do this. Yes, I'll do that. And I think Bernie's team has done that. I think it's not as appealing to say, oh, I'm going to go through this and then this process and all, I think that my peers that support Sanders are really clinging to the idea that, they have a right to be idealistic and why should they settle? And, is that what the country's come to, that they have to settle for somebody they're not excited about? I think that there's a lot of other things going on that might cause them to not be excited about Hillary Clinton. But I do think it's fair to say, why can't we be idealistic? Why can't we have these policies? And then at the end of the day, you have to eventually answer that, we can't. Like, those things literally will not happen in the next 8 years, maybe in time. But, I think that's really the tension of sort of the trade-off of being, pragmatist versus idealistic. And I think she hit the nail on the head when she said, I'm a progressive who gets things done, because that really is what the campaign became about once she articulated that. It was hard to articulate, early on too, as an early supporter, why, Hillary over Sanders without sort of getting into a whole long dialogue. I think that sums it up nicely, measured progress is really what we can achieve here, hopefully. So,
yeah, realistic results. And I think that's what overall, I think that's what all Americans want, realistic results. And, I want to get your take on the Democratic Party in terms of the outlook, because you mentioned something that I have experienced in discussion with a lot of focus groups, with a lot of young people. One of the things that troubles a lot of millennials, the lack of diversity in the Democratic Party, when it's the party that has the most diverse base, the most loyal diverse base. But, when you look at optics, I had he was 19. He said, if you were just to go by optics, the way things look, if you were to look at the Republicans in terms of who they've got, with Marco Rubio, with Ted Cruz, and then, they've done a lot with Nikki Haley, and you see the diversity there, it is a fact when you're looking at generations. I mean, the first millennial to get elected to Congress was a Republican. And Aaron Schrock, unfortunately, he's no longer in the House, but he got there. And then when you look at the demographics of the Democrats that are in Congress, the majority of Gen Xers and millennials are actually Republicans. And that's something that a lot of young people have said that, you know, they're concerned about that because you get that label that of, it seems to be a labeled reputation of the Democrats of being much more open and much more friendly to diversity, more of a big tent. But at the same time, these are the results that we have. And, you know, I just want to get your take or your thoughts on something like that.
Right. I mean, I think there is this idea that, you know, there's effective diversity and literal diversity. And, you know, I think that the Republicans have done a good job of creating certainly a photograph that's diverse when you have those candidates on stage. But ideologically, you know, if you look at their records, they're not really candidates that support policies that will uplift diverse communities, in my opinion. I think it is a problem in politics everywhere that people are whiter or older, you know, tend to be male. That's a problem. I think it's upon us to run for things and be really active. And of course, it's easy to say. With somebody with my background, I think it's harder for, you know, people of different kind of lower socioeconomic groups to gain access to that. And I think that there are groups working on that. I know a bunch of my peers, at least when I was an undergrad at Brown, were working on groups to engage and help, you know, millennials run for office and, yes, you know, help them figure it out. So I think things like that are coming up. We need to do more. I think that, again, you know, first of all, we have two candidates really that were being considered in the race. So the probability that, you know, we had that diverse picture is less likely. To begin with, I, you know, it's still not great, but I think, you know, looking at the policies is probably more important than literally. I think it's important to have sort of that symbolic, you know, if you can see it, you can be it type. Right. But they also have to have the content there to get policies on a macro level that are going to uplift those communities. I think that's much more important.
You're right. That the saying politics is local, that definitely is that. And that's interesting that you shared about your classmates there at Brown at trying to pull something together for millennials to run. That's that in a lot of the focus groups that I've run and talked to people, that's one of the things that people are trying to do across the country. And here in Los Angeles, those conversations are being had. And that seems to be something, I know for me as a journalist, I do try not to be emotional, but at the same time, I'm very impressed and very encouraged by, I think, some of that, some of that thinking that people are really starting to try to figure out how to get people in the game of politics and people who should be in, I think, in running for public office for sure. Now, just as a thought about some of the primaries, your thoughts, your opinions on so far how things have been going. Have you witnessed any surprises in any of these Democratic primaries at all with the results? Let's go back to last week with Super Tuesday. Was there a surprise? Anything that you thought was out of the ordinary?
You know, I think that Hillary supporters were really happy that she won Massachusetts because it was close. I think that what that says, basically, because Massachusetts, by the way, is not really that diverse a state. It's pretty white, at least for the Democratic base. You know, it's pretty white Democratic base and a pretty liberal Democratic base. And that's kind of Camp Bernie. And so the fact that he didn't win that state is kind of a nice bellwether of, like, how things might go as we get to the other states. I think you already brought up, you know, Hillary already has about, I don't know if it's over half or almost half of the delegate she needs to secure the nomination. It's near there. And so I think at some point, as she keeps gaining delegates and it keeps becoming mathematically less likely that Sanders is going to win, as you have sort of this, like, catastrophic Trump character on the other side that, like, you know, I guess Democrats are preparing for battle against, really, like, when is he going to drop out and, you know, join forces and help unify the party, because I think the party really has divided in a really, like, possibly unexpected way.
It is.
There's a lot of vitriol. It's a lot of, especially on Twitter, like, if you... right? Like, on our feet, on things I post on our account, you know, like, it gets very aggressive, and we need those people to come out and vote for Hillary Clinton when she secures the nomination, hopefully. So I think that that sort of repair process needs to be happening sooner rather than later. I think after Super Tuesday, her campaign, you know, I think mentally they probably pivoted a while ago, but I think they got a little nervous at first. After Super Tuesday, they kind of confirmed she's going to be the nominee. She's pivoted now to more of this loving, kindness, unity, anti-hate, anti-Trump message, and sort of downplayed Bernie. And I think, you know, they're setting their sights on the general. And I think the sooner that the Democrats can do that together, the better a chance we have of stopping, you know, somebody who really has a lot of hateful things to say that I don't think is reflecting well on the country right now.
You know, what's interesting, what you mentioned about the vitriol on social media. It is true. Some of it I watch, you know, as a former communications director. I've worked both here in California and in Florida. And some of the things that I see, I can't believe it. And then it, and then I kind of step back and analyze some of it. I think some of it is from either folks who have just gotten involved in the process, the voting process, and they may not really understand that. And then there are individuals who have been outliers to begin with and may never have fit in either voting category. And then there are just some people, and I thought, not that, and I've done interviews with the Green Party, you know, the Green Party team is a friend to the show, but yeah. Some people, for what they're looking for or what they're asking for, I do ask, why aren't you registered Green? Why are you a registered Democrat? Because, you know, that's right. Never been what the party stood for, and it's not ever going to be defined that way. And, you know, just some of the things, like, I think the best way I could describe it is modern hippies. Not that I think all Green Party members are hippies, but I think well-meaning folks, but at some point when you talk anti-establishment in terms of financial contributions, you don't vote. You normally don't vote in either of the two major parties. I mean, money's good. It's just that good people need to have the money. And good people who know that the money is used to getting a message out. That's the difference. You know, it's not, and it's people, good people giving money who are not afraid to let people know their names. You know, that there's a difference with that. And sometimes it seems like with a lot of the vitriol that's going on, people are getting that confusing, and it's sort of, you can kind of tell that there are some people who are kind of new to the process. And one of the things I know with African-American voters that I've talked to, that a lot of them are firmly in Hillary's camp. They, whether it's, their families did extremely well under Bill Clinton. And as far as they're concerned, they have no problem with Hillary. They actually, a lot in the African-American community consider her to be the most qualified person running to begin with. So, people don't have a problem with that. And then there are some people who have remarked, and some of the social media comments I've gotten today, they said, why not have Hillary? Not only is she more qualified, but, we need to redefine the role of the first spouse, you know? So, and the best way to do this in these times is to have a former president. And and I think everybody's calling him, they're saying Bill for first dude, you know, which I think is kind of cool, but, definitely it's something that, does need to be said. And what you mentioned about unifying the party, in the unexpected way that things have been splintered, you're absolutely right, because you've got someone who is an independent has basically decided to run. And in some circles, some political circles, they're referring to he's renting the party. And, you know, it's you can't talk against something and then, but you want the Rolodex, so to speak. And, you know, so it definitely, it's going to be interesting. And your generation, I really think what's going to happen is that I think you'll redefine the Democratic Party for sure. But I somehow, though, I think what you're going to do is you are going to correct some of the things that are going on. And I just want to get your idea of I just want to ask you from your perspective, if you were given the ability to reshape the Democratic Party, how would you do it?
How would I do it? Okay, wow. Small question. I think that, again, it is, I think the idea that the Democratic Party is all about super centralized government, I don't think is true. I think that, you know, Hillary Clinton talks a lot about making sure down ticket races win. And I think that those are very important elections. And that is how a lot of government gets done. And if it's not, it's how it should get done. So I think really taking a close look at, you know, what communities are not being well represented, like Ferguson, for example, by, you know, the leadership at some point, like you mentioned before, should start to sort of represent the community that it represents, because it should be representative. You know, it's kind of the definition. So I think that getting closer to that is really the goal. And I think that the main thing both parties need to do is use technology and use social media to, like you said, disseminate important, correct information to people that might not otherwise have access to it with the new tools that we have. So like social media, you know, there's so much that we could be telling people, you know, and so many different people, by the way, that haven't been included before that you know, have a phone that accesses Twitter, whatever it is, mm-hmm. that they can now, you know, start to get access to different ideas and learn about these things and learn how to engage. And also it works the other way. You know, I think Cory Booker does a great job on Twitter, if you follow him, of he really actually engages individual constituents in a way that nobody ever could before, because you literally don't have time to go physically meet those people. Mm-hmm. On social media, you can very easily, you know, and safely communicate with your constituents in an important way. So I'd like to see a lot more of that.
You know, you bring up Cory Booker as a perfect example of how how an elected official should communicate in modern times. And in addition to Cory Booker, our mayor here in Los Angeles, Eric Garcetti, which is who he's friends. He's actually friends with Senator Booker. They're former Rhodes Scholars together. And they definitely using social media is a telltale. And that's a research item that I've actually looked at among members of both the House and the Senate. And unfortunately, it's very telling with the politician at what their feed looks like. And, you know, we love our ladies here in California, but I will say sometimes, you know, Senator Feinstein and Senator Boxer, those timelines are a little spotty in terms of days and even the issues that are involved. And I think, you know, Senator Booker has done an excellent job at harnessing that communication, as well as he not only uses it to connect with constituents, but I think what he does is he does so well is he also gives his constituents a window into him. And, right. You know, and that's something that a lot of politicians don't do. And I think there's, for some of the ones that may have been there 20, 30 years, that could be problematic for them. And, you know, just, and that's some of the things that I've looked at. And in some of our focus groups, you know, we've talked about that with some young people. And right now, it doesn't seem like young people are using that as a factor as to who they vote for. But they have remarked that that would be an important tool for them if they wouldn't be opposed to someone being able to communicate. And they actually feel like that might be something that could deal with a lot of apathy, particularly with young voters. Because, and I've even had some young voters say, well, I don't really do Twitter, but if he or she has Snapchat, you know, which, you know, that works. But you're absolutely right about social media use for sure. Have you thought about just other ideas that, you know, with your group Millennials for Hillary, have you thought about any other creative ways to reach maybe some of those demographics that may be undecided or may not be in the know?
Yeah. So again, I really do think that, you know, not just social media, but technology, like a professor that I was working with in undergrad, you know, had a Fulbright, went and ended up founding this company with a group of millennials that basically it's an online tool for collaborative decision-making. It's called Lumio. People want to check it out. Okay. It's now in like over 90 countries. In Spain, they actually used it in the election. It played a role because one of the political parties was using this online tool to get people to collaborate and decide things online so they don't have to go to rallies. It's very, you know, accessible as long as you have internet connection, which again is not everyone has, but you know, it's one step closer for sure. And again, you can have discussion. You can really include people that otherwise, you know, don't have the time to go physically or travel and go to these events, are not physically able to do it, or you know, don't really feel comfortable so publicly and you know, formally committing to these sort of groups. Whereas you can just kind of go see. You don't even have to comment on a post if you want. You can read what other people are thinking and you know, be a part of it that way and sort of be a little bit. You know, you can be as passive as you like or as active as you like. I think that's nice about technology. And again, the accessibility is just key.
You know, you're right. And, you know, the use of technology, of course, we saw the power of that in 2008 when the Obama campaign basically used it to basically, I would say, destroy the Republican Party in terms of outreach and efficiency, and actually even up the game in 2012, because I remember getting buzzed on my social media, you know, based on it was actually really cool. It was creepy, but it was kind of cool at the same time, where I was being pinged to ask my friends had they voted, and even though I'm on the West Coast and my friends on the East Coast, I remember getting that email and it had different lists. Well, it was a status and it kept just flashing on my computer. And at first, I thought, is somebody watching me? And then, of course, when I looked at it and afterwards, I thought, this is really cool, and it. Definitely, I think the Obama campaign taught the DNC that they needed to up their game, because actually the Obama campaign didn't allow the leadership of the DNC to kind of take the helm a lot. And so it's going to be interesting in this game how technology for the Democrats will work. And terms of voter outreach, not only with the young, but now you've got, between Gen Xers and millennials, that's the two large, together combined, those are the two most tech-savvy groups in the U.S. And it's going to be interesting at how that technology game gets up, but you're right about that, how the use of technology has kind of changed the game. And what I see on the Republican side, though, because their base is still rather, it's much more mature. And it seems like their social media item of choice has to be Facebook, because that, you can definitely tell, and just even here with this show, I don't get a lot of, I get most of the comments I get are conservative voters, or any posts that we make, conservatives jump on it. So they're watching that medium. but I don't get very many conservatives that are posting on Twitter and Instagram. Other than I do friends to the show, the Young Republicans, they will post and interact with me. But pretty much when you talk about rank and file voters, the conservatives really are. So that is going to be interesting, though. And the tool that you talked about, Lumia, that's a very interesting item. And have you said it's in 90 countries?
Yeah, something like that. You know, it's LOOMIO.org for people that want to check it out. And yeah, basically, it started after the Occupy Wall Street movement. You know, kind of just thinking, because I think a lot of the criticism of that movement was, you know, there was no action plan, there was no follow up. There was like a lot of will, and then they didn't know how to channel that big mass will into action.
Results.
And so I think a big goal of this is, okay, now get those people with the will together and do it in a really accessible, easy way. And then have this platform where they can start thinking through different issues and decide things and, you know, come up with the next steps and execute them. So I think that as we see technology develop, like Lumio, for example, like, hopefully that's going to increase engagement. I also think, you know, like this year I saw Facebook, you know, this is a party neutral thing that they do where it's like, did you vote? Go vote. Share your status if you voted. Here's your voting poll. I'd love to see more of that because, again, increasing participation is, we have a, you know, terrible participation rate in the U.S. and we've had for a long time. So
you're right. And, you know, with that, you are such a dynamic guest. I have to have you back. We're almost out of time. And what I'd like for you to do is please share with our listeners who want to start following you, get social with you. So how can they get social with you on social media?
Sure. So you can follow me on Twitter, and it's at KAIVANSHROFF, Kaivan Shroff, or our Millennial for Hillary account is Still With Her. And we just launched a Facebook page. So if you look up Millennials for Hillary, you'll find it there.
Okay, great. And, do you also have, a blog or,
I have a blog that I also just started, kaivanshroff.com, and it's the same spelling as everything else. So.
Excellent. Well, we will definitely make that available on our page. Yeah. And we have to have you back. You are now an official friend to the show. We've got to keep up with you, but, thank you so much for joining me and chatting with me and giving us a good millennial take on the, election, the primaries right now. And, to our listeners, again, I want to thank you so much. Remember you can hit me up on Facebook at Janet Foster and on Twitter and Instagram at Janet D. Foster. I'd like to thank my sound engineer and extraordinaire Mr. MacGyver on everything who makes this thing go, Jeremy Hansen, everyone here in Los Angeles, and those of you who are listening nationwide. Have a great week. We'll be back here, same time, same place. Thank you.